we're going deep today into a really heavy topic.
Yeah.
Trying to understand, I guess, what could lead a mother to, well, to take the life of her own child. Mm. It's, you know, it's called filicide.
Yeah.
And the research that we're looking at is really fascinating. He uses attachment theory to try to shed some light on why this might happen, you know, not to sensationalize it.
Right.
Just to try to understand it a little better.
It's a heartbreaking topic for sure.
So this research paper we're looking at goes pretty deep.
Mm-hmm.
It analyzed data from three different groups of mothers, a control group, mothers who were dealing with mental illness, and mothers who had actually committed filicide.
Yeah, they wanted to go a little deeper than just, you know, basic demographics or diagnosis.
All right.
They wanted to understand the more subtle psychological mechanisms that might be at play.
Now, we all know that things like poverty, past trauma, those are often cited as risk factors, right?
Of course.
But the interesting thing is this study found that those factors were present in both the mothers with mental illness and the mothers who committed filicide.
Right.
So that leaves us with this big question. If those factors alone aren't the whole story, what else is going on?
Yeah, that's the big question.
You know, what could be driving these tragic outcomes? Mm-hmm. What else could be happening?
That's where attachment theory comes in.
Okay.
Attachment theory really focuses on, you know, the early bond between a child and their caregiver,
mm-hmm.
and how that really shapes their emotional development.
Even into adulthood.
Yeah, even into adulthood, it lays the groundwork for how they relate to other people.
Oh, interesting.
How they handle their emotions.
So like that early bond kind of sets the stage for how they're going to navigate relationships.
Exactly. Exactly. And to assess this in adults, researchers use a tool called the Adult Attachment Interview.
Okay.
Or they call it the AAI for short.
Okay, the AAI.
And it really helps them understand how an adult views their early relationships.
So they use this AAI to kind of get into the emotional world of these mothers.
Yeah.
See how they saw their own childhoods.
Exactly. And they used two different coding systems to analyze the interviews.
Oh, wow.
So they had one that was, you know, the standard system.
Okay.
But then they also used one that was specifically designed for high-risk populations.
Interesting.
So it gave them a more comprehensive view.
I see. So they're really trying to get a detailed picture.
Yes.
So what did they find out? What did the research actually reveal about these mothers?
Well, they found that the mothers who committed filicide were much more likely to have specific attachment patterns.
Right.
One of them is called insecure entangled attachment.
Insecure entangled.
Yeah. So think about a mother who's, you know, still deeply affected by, you know, negative emotions tied to past relationships. It's almost like she's trapped in those difficult dynamics from her own childhood.
Almost like those wounds never healed.
Exactly.
Right. So that's insecure entangled.
Yeah. And then there's also unresolved attachment, which is another pattern they commonly found.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of like carrying the weight of past hurts and losses, especially those related to her own caregivers.
So it sounds like their own unresolved trauma almost like it spills over into their ability to mother.
Mm-hmm.
So that's two patterns.
Right.
Insecure entangled and unresolved attachment.
Yes. But perhaps the most significant finding was the prevalence of something called hostile helpless attachment.
Hostile helpless.
Or they call it HH.
Okay.
And this was actually, you know, more than mental illness alone, this was a really strong predictor of filicide.
HH. That sounds kind of ominous.
It is. It suggests an inability to really process
mm-hmm.
and cope with negative experiences in those crucial early attachments.
So it's not just about having a mental illness.
Right.
It's about how those past relationships impact a mother's ability to parent.
Yeah, exactly. And within this hostile, helpless pattern, there's a really particularly high prevalence of the helpless subtype in these mothers.
The helpless subtype. So what does that look like?
Well, these mothers often identify very strongly with a caregiver who was, you know, either emotionally unavailable or just completely overwhelmed.
Wow.
So imagine, you know, growing up feeling like your needs weren't met,
yeah.
like your caregiver was constantly struggling.
Mm-hmm.
It can create this really deep sense of vulnerability.
I see.
And inadequacy that these mothers carry into their own parenting.
Almost like a cycle.
Right.
Of inadequate care.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And this is where we see that kind of the cumulative effect of these risk factors, you know, the poverty, the trauma, and then these very specific attachment patterns. This study emphasized that all of these things together create a much, much higher risk for filicide than any one of those factors alone.
So it's like a almost like a perfect storm.
Yes, exactly.
Wow. So we're starting to get a much clearer picture here.
Yes.
It's not just a simple equation.
Right.
It's this complex interplay of emotional and psychological factors.
Exactly.
And I'm particularly interested in this helpless subtype.
Mm-hmm.
What makes it so crucial, you know, in the context of filicide?
Well, what's really fascinating about the helpless subtype is, you know, it really reflects this deep sense of powerlessness in these mothers.
Mm-hmm.
And they often describe their own caregivers as, you know, overwhelmed,
yeah,
unable to cope.
Right.
And they seem to internalize that feeling.
Oh, wow.
And carry it with them into motherhood.
So they're not just witnessing these struggles.
Right.
They're absorbing that same feeling.
Exactly.
Of being overwhelmed.
And that can manifest in different ways. You know, some mothers might withdraw.
Okay.
You know, they become passive, detached,
mm-hmm.
while others might, you know, sort of erupt in anger and frustration.
Yeah.
But underneath all of that, there's this core belief.
Mm-hmm.
I am not capable of being a good parent.
Oh, wow.
And that's the real tragedy here.
It's like that feeling of hopelessness.
Yeah.
Just permeates everything.
And it's what makes it even more heartbreaking is that these mothers often genuinely love their children.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, their own unresolved trauma, their attachment patterns, it clouds their judgment,
mm-hmm.
and their ability to actually provide the care that their children need.
Like there's a disconnect between, like you said, their intentions.
Right.
And their actions.
Exactly. And that's why this research is so crucial. It shows that understanding these underlying emotional and psychological factors.
Right.
Especially, you know, in families that might be high risk, this could be a key to actually preventing these tragedies.
Now, that brings up a really important question. You know,
mm-hmm.
if these attachment patterns are so influential.
Right.
Can they be changed?
That's the big question.
Can those wounds be healed?
Well, you know, research does offer some hope.
Yeah.
You know, early childhood experiences are definitely very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
But our brains are capable of change and growth.
Okay.
Throughout our lives.
So even though they might be carrying these wounds from their past.
Right.
It's not hopeless.
Absolutely not. You know, there are therapeutic approaches.
Okay.
Like attachment-based therapy that can help people process these early experiences.
Okay.
Develop healthier ways of coping.
Yeah.
And build more secure attachments.
Even later in life.
Yes. Even later in life.
Ah.
So it's about giving these mothers the tools.
Yeah.
And the support to break free from those cycles and to, you know, start believing in their ability to be good parents.
Right, right.
And early intervention here is crucial.
Yeah.
The sooner that we can identify these at-risk families
and
provide support, the better chance we have
of
preventing these tragedies.
You mentioned attachment-based therapy, which sounds promising.
Yeah.
But I imagine that's just one piece of the puzzle, right?
It is.
What other kinds of support might be helpful for these families?
Well, you know, on a broader level, I think we need to, you know, really address societal issues like poverty, access to mental health care.
Right.
You know, we need to really support struggling families.
Yeah.
And just acknowledge that these are all interconnected issues.
Yeah,
you know, they require this multi-pronged approach.
It's like creating a safety net.
Exactly.
For these families.
Yes.
Okay.
And on a more individual level, you know, things like parenting classes, you know, home visits from social workers.
Right.
Access to counseling.
Right.
You know, these can all play a role in, you know, supporting parents and nurturing healthy child development.
It sounds like a real collaborative effort.
It is.
Professionals, the communities, and the families all working together.
Exactly. It's about recognizing that, you know, parenting is tough.
Yeah.
And everyone deserves support, especially those facing, you know, extra hurdles.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, going back to the study, it really emphasized that these specific attachment patterns, especially the HH,
right.
You know, the hostile helpless, were stronger predictors of filicide than mental illness alone.
Yes.
Can you talk about why that's so important to highlight?
Yeah. You know, I think it challenges some common misconceptions about mental illness and violence.
Okay.
While, you know, some mental health conditions can increase the risk of aggression,
mm-hmm.
it's really important to remember that most people with mental illness are not violent.
Right, right.
And violence is never a foregone conclusion.
So it's about moving away from those generalizations.
Exactly. Right. And recognizing that mental illness is just one factor in this much bigger, bigger picture.
Right, right. And this research is saying that it's not just about the mental illness. It's how it interacts with these other factors.
Exactly.
Like those attachment patterns.
Especially those deep-rooted attachment patterns.
Okay.
That can really elevate the risk for, these tragic outcomes.
Right, right. So we need to be more holistic in our approach.
Yes.
Not just jumping to conclusions based on a diagnosis.
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay. And I know, before we shift gears, I want to touch on one more thing that really stood out to me.
Yeah.
In the research. And that was how these mothers often viewed their children.
It's a crucial piece of the puzzle.
It is.
They found that these mothers, especially those with that helpless subtype.
Right.
They often saw their children as reflections of their own shortcomings.
So they not only felt inadequate as parents.
Right.
They projected those feelings.
Exactly. They projected those feelings onto their children.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It's as if they saw their kids as these constant reminders of their perceived failures.
Yeah.
And it led to this really, really distorted dynamic.
I bet.
In their relationship.
So it makes it even harder to connect.
Of course.
And provide that nurturing environment.
Exactly. Instead of seeing their children as, these unique individuals.
Yeah.
With their own needs and desires, they view them as extensions of themselves.
Oh, wow.
These burdens.
Yeah.
That just reinforce their own feelings of helplessness.
It's like this vicious cycle of self-blame and projection.
Exactly.
Where the child almost becomes the scapegoat.
Yes.
For the mother's own pain.
And that's where, early intervention and support are just so vital.
Yeah.
Because if we can help these mothers address their own trauma and build a healthier sense of self-worth, they're more likely to see their children in a more, a more positive and realistic light.
To see them as individuals. Not responsible for their pain.
Exactly. It's about empowering them
to
see their children as individuals who are worthy of love and care. Separate from their own burdens.
And that shift in perspective could make all the difference.
It can, absolutely.
Yeah, it can be the key to a healthier relationship.
It really can. It can be the key to fostering a more nurturing and supportive parent-child relationship.
Now, I know we've been talking about some heavy stuff.
Yeah.
But I think it's really important to end this part of our deep dive on a note of hope.
Yes.
This research is suggesting that change is possible.
Absolutely.
These outcomes, they're not inevitable.
No, not at all.
So by understanding the complexities of filicide, we can create more effective prevention and support systems.
Exactly. Right.
And that means focusing on, like you said, early intervention, access to mental health care, addressing these bigger societal issues like poverty.
Right.
Inequality.
Yes.
And really just creating a culture that supports families.
Yeah. It's a multifaceted challenge.
It is.
But one that we can, absolutely tackle if we work together and foster a deeper understanding of these issues. Together we can create a safer, more nurturing world.
For kids.
Yes, for all children.
And that's a goal worth fighting for.
Absolutely.
And before we move on, I want to shift our focus just a little bit.
Yeah.
This study, it really centered on mothers, but it makes me think, what about the role of fathers in these tragedies?
It's definitely an important point to consider.
Yeah.
While this specific research didn't examine, paternal filicide, it's a very real issue.
It is.
And it demands, more research and attention.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I wonder if those same attachment patterns and risk factors are at play.
Yeah, it's a good question.
When we're talking about fathers who commit filicide.
Right. Understanding the unique dynamics.
Yeah.
And the challenges that fathers face, both in general.
Right.
But also within these high-risk families, that's key to developing, truly effective prevention strategies.
So it's recognizing that filicide. It's not a gender-specific issue.
No.
Right.
Both mothers and fathers.
Can be vulnerable.
Can be vulnerable to these tragic outcomes.
Yeah, and by continuing to explore these really complex issues, we can we can hopefully work towards creating a world where all children are safe.
Absolutely.
And nurtured.
Yes.
You know, that's a powerful thought to carry with us. We've covered a lot of ground already.
Yes, we have.
And I know this, you know, this is difficult to process.
It is, you know, and if anything that we've discussed so far,
yeah,
you know, resonates with you,
yeah,
or if you're feeling, you know, overwhelmed or concerned, please reach out for support.
There are resources out there.
There are.
You know, yeah. Hotlines.
Yes.
Websites. Mental health professionals.
Yes.
All ready to provide guidance.
Absolutely.
And assistance.
You're not alone.
You're not alone in this.
Not at all. And remember, knowledge is power. Mm-hmm. The more we understand these issues,
yeah,
the better equipped we are,
yeah,
to create positive change.
Absolutely. Yeah. Now, and on that note, we're gonna wrap up this part.
Okay.
Of our deep dive into filicide and attachment theory.
That was good.
Be sure to join us for the next part.
Yeah.
Where we'll delve even further into this crucial topic.
Looking forward to it.
It's really interesting, you know, as we're talking about these attachment patterns and how they impact mothers, it makes me think, do those same principles apply to fathers too?
That's a good point.
Because fathers have, you know, their own childhood experiences and attachment histories.
Absolutely.
That shape how they approach parenthood.
Yeah. I mean, we often focus on the mother's role.
Right.
But, you know, fathers also have emotional baggage, past experiences that can really influence how they bond with their kids, how they manage stress.
Right.
How they handle the demands of being a parent.
So even though this study, you know, focused on mothers, could we say that unresolved trauma, insecure attachment, even those feelings of helplessness we talked about, could those play a role in paternal filicide as well?
I think that's a valid hypothesis.
Okay.
And it really highlights, you know, the need for more research,
yeah,
in this area to really understand those unique factors that might contribute to filicide in fathers.
Because we can't just assume that those same patterns apply equally to both parents.
Right.
Right. There are nuances.
Exactly. And those nuances extend to how those attachment patterns and emotional struggles might be expressed.
Okay.
You know, we often talk about how mothers tend to internalize their stress.
Right.
Whereas fathers might externalize it.
More like through anger.
Anger, aggression.
Right. Right. And we see that in, you know, in all different areas of life, not just parenting.
Exactly.
But those outward expressions, especially if they're rooted in unresolved trauma or, you know, those feelings of helplessness,
mm-hmm,
could those escalate into violence in extreme cases?
Like, they certainly could.
So it's not just about recognizing those emotional wounds,
yeah,
in fathers.
It's also about understanding how they might manifest differently.
Okay.
And finding ways to address those specific challenges.
So it might involve tailoring therapeutic approaches, maybe.
It might.
To better suit how men, you know, communicate and process their emotions.
Absolutely.
Maybe support groups specifically for fathers.
Yeah.
Or incorporating these concepts into parenting classes designed for both parents.
Exactly.
So a more inclusive and comprehensive approach.
I think that's essential. We need to empower both parents with the knowledge, the skills,
yeah,
the resources that they need.
To create that safe environment.
Yeah, absolutely.
And speaking of resources, I think it's important to remind our listener that help is available,
mm-hmm,
for anyone struggling with, you know, parenting challenges.
Absolutely.
Whether it's attachment issues, mental health concerns, or just the general stresses of raising a family.
Yeah.
You don't have to go through this alone.
No, not at all. There are hotlines, websites.
Support groups,
mental health professionals.
Yeah.
Who are trained to provide guidance and assistance.
Mm.
And there is absolutely no shame in seeking help.
Right.
In fact, I think it's a sign of strength.
Yeah.
A commitment to being the best parent you can be.
I love that. Yeah. Reaching out for help is not a weakness. It's like a superpower.
It is. It means you're recognizing you don't have to do this alone.
Right.
And there are people who want to support you.
Okay.
And it's also crucial to remember that, you know, these challenges, as difficult as they may be,
yeah,
they are not insurmountable. You know, with the right support, the right interventions, families can heal. They can grow.
Yeah.
They can create a more positive future.
That's good. That's good to hear. Now, you mentioned the concept of intergenerational trauma earlier.
Mm-hmm.
This idea that unhealthy patterns can be passed down.
Yeah, it's great.
One generation to the next. Can you unpack that a little bit?
Yeah, intergenerational trauma is often very subtle.
Okay.
But it can have a really powerful impact on families.
Okay.
You know, it's the idea that trauma, whether it's abuse, neglect, violence, or even systemic oppression, it can leave these deep emotional scars.
Okay.
That are then transmitted to future generations.
So it's not just genetics, it's learned behaviors.
It is, yeah.
Coping mechanisms.
Yes.
Even like subconscious beliefs.
Right.
About relationships, about the world.
Exactly.
That we pass down.
It's like, let's say a parent experienced neglect or abuse as a child.
Mm-hmm.
They might find it difficult to form secure attachments with their own children.
Right.
Even if they desperately want to be a good parent.
Yeah.
It's like those early experiences, they create this blueprint for how we approach relationships.
Yeah.
How we approach parenting, even if we're not consciously aware of it.
So how do we break those cycles? If we're, you know, unconsciously following these blueprints, how do we become more aware of our own patterns?
Well, I think awareness is the first step.
Okay.
You know, recognizing our own attachment patterns.
Mm-hmm.
Understanding how our past might be influencing our present.
Okay.
And being willing to seek help if we need to, to develop healthier ways of coping, relating to others.
So it's not about like blaming our parents or feeling trapped by our past.
It's about acknowledging those influences and then making conscious choices.
Okay.
To create a different future.
For our children.
For ourselves. For our children.
And that awareness can be really empowering.
It can be. Not just for ourselves, but for our children.
Mm-hmm.
And future generations.
Future generations. Wow. By healing those wounds, breaking those cycles, we can create this ripple effect of positive change that extends far beyond our immediate family.
I love that image. The idea that we can create this positive change that just that resonates through generations.
Yeah.
It's a really powerful thought.
It is.
It highlights the importance of our actions.
Yeah.
As parents.
Right.
The impact they can have, not just on our kids.
But on the world around us.
On the world.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as we kind of wrap up this segment, we'll leave our listener with this question. What's one small step you can take today to become more aware of your own attachment patterns?
Yeah.
And how they might be influencing your parenting?
That's a great question. And it doesn't have to be a grand gesture.
Okay.
You know, maybe it's simply taking some time to reflect on your own childhood experiences.
Okay.
Noticing how you react to stress in your parenting role.
Okay.
Or even, you know, exploring some resources on attachment theory to deepen your understanding.
Deepen your understanding. Remember, every journey begins with a single step.
It does.
And by taking those steps towards awareness and healing, we create a brighter future.
We do.
For ourselves, for our children, and for the generations to come.
Mm-hmm.
Now, before we get too far ahead of ourselves, I want to circle back to a point that we touched on earlier.
Okay.
The study really emphasized that these specific attachment patterns, especially the helpless subtype, were much stronger predictors of filicide than mental illness alone.
Yeah.
I'm curious, why is that distinction so crucial?
It's crucial because it challenges, I think, some very common misconceptions about mental illness and violence.
Yeah.
You know, while certain mental health conditions can increase the risk of aggressive behavior, we have to remember that most people with mental illness are not violent.
Right.
And violence is never a foregone conclusion based on a diagnosis.
Okay. So it's about moving away from those generalizations.
Exactly.
Right.
And recognizing that mental illness is just one piece of a much larger puzzle.
Yeah.
And what this research is really highlighting is it's not just about the presence of mental illness. It's about the interplay of that illness with other factors.
Okay.
Like these ingrained attachment patterns that can really elevate the risk for these tragic outcomes.
So we need to be kind of taking a more holistic approach.
A holistic approach.
Right. Not making assumptions based on a single diagnosis.
Exactly. And that broader perspective is so crucial for both prevention and intervention efforts.
Okay.
You know, we need to be mindful of the bigger picture.
The bigger picture.
And understand there's no one-size-fits-all solution to these complex issues.
Okay. Now, as we kind of, as we delve a little deeper into this, I want to shift our attention back to those filicidal mothers.
Okay.
And how they viewed their children.
Yeah.
The research paper really highlighted some pretty significant findings.
It did. You know, the study found that these mothers, especially those with the helpless subtype, they often saw their children as reflections of their own inadequacy.
So it wasn't just that they felt incapable as parents. They actually projected those feelings.
They did. They projected those feelings of inadequacy onto their children.
Wow.
And it created this this very distorted, unhealthy dynamic in their relationships.
And I can imagine how much that must have hindered their ability to really connect with their children and provide, you know, a nurturing environment.
Absolutely. Instead of seeing their children as these unique individuals with their own needs and desires,
right,
they saw them as extensions of themselves,
right,
burdens that intensified their own feelings of helplessness.
It's heartbreaking to think about. It's like a tragic cycle of self-blame and projection, mm-hmm, where the child becomes the scapegoat for the mother's own unresolved pain.
And that's why, you know, early intervention and support are so vital. Because if we can help these mothers work through their own trauma and develop a healthier sense of self-worth, they're more likely to see their children in a more positive, realistic light.
It's about breaking those patterns of negative thinking.
Absolutely.
And projection.
Yeah, it's about empowering these mothers to see their children as individuals who are deserving of love and care separate from their own struggles.
And that shift in perspective can be really transformative.
It can. It can be the key to unlocking a more nurturing and supportive parent-child relationship.
We've explored some difficult topics, some heartbreaking topics. This is a deep dive.
Yeah.
But it's essential to end this part of our conversation on a hopeful note.
Absolutely.
The research we've discussed suggests that change is possible.
It does.
These tragedies, they're not inevitable.
Not at all.
So by understanding the complexities of filicide, we can develop more effective prevention strategies and support systems.
Yeah.
And that includes advocating for early intervention, ensuring access to mental health care, addressing those broader societal issues, like poverty, inequality, and fostering a culture that truly values families and supports families.
A multifaceted challenge.
It is.
But one that I think we can certainly tackle if we work together and we strive for a deeper understanding of these issues. Mm-hmm. Together, we can create a safer and more nurturing world for all children.
And that's a powerful message. That's a goal worth striving for.
It is.
Now, before we move on to our final thoughts on this topic, I want to pose a question that's been lingering in my mind.
Okay.
We've talked a lot about, you know, the emotional and psychological aspects of filicide.
Mm-hmm.
But what about the role of societal expectations and pressures?
Right.
Do those play a role?
That's an excellent point.
In these tragedies.
It's an excellent point. And one that I think often gets overlooked. You know, we place such unrealistic expectations on parents, particularly mothers.
Right.
To be perfect, to be self-sacrificing.
Right.
And those pressures can be overwhelming, especially for individuals who are already struggling, you know, with their own emotional burdens.
So it's not just about the individual factors. It's also about the cultural context in which parenting takes place.
Exactly.
Right.
And that means that, you know, we need to challenge those unrealistic expectations.
Okay.
We need to create more supportive communities and foster a culture that values, you know, empathy, compassion, understanding.
For all parents.
For all parents, yes.
That's a powerful message.
It is.
To carry with us as we move forward in this conversation. It's a reminder that supporting parents isn't just a personal responsibility. It's a societal responsibility.
Absolutely.
Right.
And by working together, we can create a world where all families have the opportunity to thrive and where these tragic outcomes like filicide become less frequent.
And with that powerful thought, we'll wrap up this segment of our deep dive.
Okay.
Join us for the final part where we'll explore some concluding insights and leave you with some thought-provoking questions.
Sounds good.
As we wrap up our deep dive, I keep coming back to, you know, what you were saying about those mothers and how they saw their children as reflections of their own shortcomings. It makes you think, if they could somehow address those feelings, could that change how they interact with their kids?
That's a really good question. It gets right to the heart of this research, you know. If we help these mothers process their trauma, build up their self-worth, break free from those negative thought patterns, they're more likely to see their kids in a positive light, not as like extensions of their failure.
Like unique individuals.
Exactly. Deserving of love and care, separate from their own issues. It really makes you realize how much our own self-image affects how we parent.
Absolutely. Our emotional baggage can really distort things.
It can. But the good news is that those patterns can change. With support, these mothers can learn to cope, build healthy attachments and create a more nurturing environment for their children.
That's encouraging to hear. Now, I want to touch on something we talked about before, those societal expectations on parents. Mm-hmm. We talk about how overwhelming those pressures can be. Do you think those societal factors contribute to this distorted view some mothers have of themselves and their kids?
Oh, I absolutely think they do. Society puts such unrealistic expectations on parents, especially mothers, you know, to be perfect, self-sacrificing, always put their children first. It's damaging, especially for mothers who are already struggling. We almost set them up to fail.
It's true. What if we created a more supportive environment for parents, acknowledged the challenges, celebrated the imperfections? Yeah. Could that prevent these tragedies?
I think it could make a huge difference. Instead of putting all the responsibility on individual parents, we need a culture that shares that responsibility. Mm-hmm. Affordable childcare, parental leave, supportive communities where parents can connect and get help.
And most importantly, challenge those unrealistic expectations. Recognize that it's okay to ask for help, to admit struggles, to put your mental health first. A healthy parent creates a healthy environment for their child.
Couldn't agree more. We need to shift our thinking. Supporting parents isn't just a nice thing. It's crucial for society. Investing in families means investing in our future.
I love that. It's a great way to look at it. Well, I want to thank you for joining me on this deep dive. It's a heavy topic, but it's so important to talk about. I believe that by understanding these issues, both personal and societal, we can prevent tragedies like this from happening.
It's been my pleasure. Remember, understanding is the first step towards change, and we can all be part of creating that change.
And to our listeners, thank you for joining us. Keep exploring this topic. Seek out resources. Talk about these things. You're not alone. By working together, we can build a better future for all families. This concludes our deep dive into filicide and attachment theory.